With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, details on upcoming hearings for a proposed statewide pesticide notification system and how the 2024 Trade Mission Agenda is seeking to build on two record years of ag exports. But our top story today, a one-year farm bill extension does not mean the Senate is done. Some hope to start work quickly to get a full bill passed before the election season starts in 2024. But that may be difficult, according to Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. She says while she was encouraged by the extension, she's not happy about it.
But having something is better than having absolutely nothing. So we've bought some time to continue working through a number of issues.
She thinks there's a lack of farm in the farm bill.
If you look at the overall bill, only about 14-15% of what's being proposed in the Senate farm bill is actually farm-related, farm programs. The rest of it is focused on food programs and things like climate change.
A lot of items she thinks may sound good but contribute to an overly large cost. Ernst says $1.4 to $1.5 trillion proposed in the Senate this year for the farm bill.
That's why we think we need to work on it, continue to whittle down the cost of the bill, but make sure that we're focusing on our hardworking farmers and ranchers.
In other news, one analyst says if you look for them, there are some positives from USDA's new farm income forecast. Gary Crawford reports.
As farmers get ready to close the books on 2023, analysts at the USDA are forecasting that this year farmers as a whole will record quite a cut in net cash income, a drop of 21% from last year's record high. But USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says we need to put the 2023 projected net cash income figure of just under $158 billion in perspective.
Despite what is a large percentage decrease on the order of 20%, in net cash farm income year over year, where we're sitting at for 2023 is still exceeds the 20-year average by quite a bit.
He says another way to look at it, if you take together net incomes from 21, 2022, and 23.
This is the three highest consecutive years in the last 50 years.
A condition Meyer says is simply
exceptional.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA will be among three agencies overseeing proposed efforts to reduce food loss and waste, and in turn, greenhouse gas emissions. That according to a newly released draft strategy. Grod Bain has more.
We are lowering emissions, not only in energy and transportation, but in industry, agriculture, buildings, and construction.
Vice President Kamala Harris over the weekend in the United Arab Emirates, site of the 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference. Also announced at COP28 this past weekend, a draft look at a proposed national strategy for reducing food loss and waste and recycling organics. The Agriculture Department, along with the Environmental Protection Agency and Food and Drug Administration, will oversee this effort, not just for food waste reduction, but climate mitigation as well. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, via press release, says this is another example of developing innovative solutions and using interagency coordination to address issues such as lowering food loss and waste and greenhouse emissions and recycling organics. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And USDA is further expanding the opportunities for producers to consider enterprise units as risk management options. The Risk Management Agency is expanding the enterprise unit availability to additional specialty crops and other actual production history crop programs. Together with the six crop types announced in July for enterprise unit protection, these crops may benefit from the enterprise units that were previously unavailable. Enterprise units are attractive to producers due to lower premium rates offered to recognize the lower risk associated with the geographic diversification. In general, the larger the enterprise unit, the lesser the risk and greater the unit discount. RMA Administrator Marsha Bunger says the announcement is in response to public feedback of producers needing more options to manage their risk. She says it's critical that while we are examining resources for areas of improvement, the agency is also listening to America's agricultural producers to hear exactly what they need. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Will Jordan, when we come back. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the future of a massive new biofuels market hangs on Treasury Department guidance for sustainable aviation fuel tax credits. It's a potential 36 billion gallon market, but it won't happen unless the Treasury Department makes it possible. Here's Renewable Fuels Association CEO Jeff Cooper.
We are waiting for Treasury to come out with that guidance that will explain to the industry how eligibility will be determined for these tax credits. We have been pushing very hard to ensure that the most current methodology, the best information, best science is used for those eligibility determinations.
Specifically, Cooper points to a holistic life cycle approach to measuring carbon emissions at all stages of ethanol production.
Using the Department of Energy's GREET model for determining eligibility, and we're expecting guidance from Treasury. I'm hearing most recently we could see it by the end of the year.
Guidance that could determine if the biofuels industry gets the tax credits needed to make expensive SAF more attractive to the airlines and boost investment in the fuel.
We're looking for methodologies that will deem eligible the largest volume of feedstocks and biofuels. If instead we end up with guidance that really only allows waste-derived SAF to qualify for the tax credit, it's really going to have a chilling impact on investment in SAF.
The ethanol industry was encouraged by the recent first-ever transatlantic flight by Virgin Air using 100% sustainable aviation fuel. The airline claims it reduced carbon emissions by 70% over conventional oil-based jet fuel. The cost and availability of propane did not take the spotlight this year with such a warm fall. This is making propane prices favorable, according to Michael Newland, the Director of Agricultural Business Development at the Propane Education Research Council. He says inventories are at their highest levels in the last 5 years.
Yes, we look at supply versus prior year versus five-year average. So going into the heating season, coming out of grain dryer season, going into heating season, we're in a great spot from a supply standpoint. Inventories are very high, probably the highest that they've been in that five-year window. So from that respect, we're looking very good. That also leads right into probably a pricing conversation that, supply and demand still applies in our industry. And with those higher supplies comes very stable pricing. So I think that's a great thing for folks.
The traditional correlation between crude oil prices and propane markets has experienced a notable change in recent years, driven by supply.
I think we're much more stable, quite honestly, than crude prices, and subsequently gasoline and diesel as well fluctuates more than what propane has in the last couple of years here. So really, I think we're on a supply track, meaning the supply is really what's driving the stability within our fuel. We export 60%+ of what we could burn here in the U.S. We're burning 40, export 60%. And what that equates to in gallons is we burn just shy of 10 billion gallons of propane here annually in the U.S.
He adds that the industry is actively pursuing innovative avenues, such as propane for vehicles.
It's an opportunity for us to explain how clean the fuel actually is. So we look at the carbon intensity scores of every fuel out there. And I talk all the time whenever I get a chance to talk. Propane is, in my opinion, the cleanest commercially available combustion fuel on the planet. You know, somebody's going to say, well, wait a minute, hydrogen is cleaner than you. And I say, well, I'll argue that, gosh, you can't roll up to a hydrogen station today and put it in a vehicle. So that day may be coming to where hydrogen has a foothold. They've got some challenges, technological challenges to overcome, I think, as far as hydrogen goes. But propane today, it's available. It's been around for an awful long time, but propane is an incredibly clean fuel, and I think it's always going to have a place in our energy conversation.
Looking ahead to 2024, Newland anticipates continued innovation, particularly in agricultural applications, with projects underway to introduce groundbreaking steam-based technologies that leverage propane to control soil nematodes.
We at the Propane Education Research Council are always looking for new companies, new projects to help that company come to market with a next generation propane burning piece of equipment. So I think we've got some neat things coming there, specifically in agriculture. We've got a really neat project that's being built in California today. We're going to use propane to produce steam that'll be injected into the soil to control soil nematodes. So I think that's a really cool technology. It's got a lot of neat applications as it gets to replace some really bad chemistry that we continue to use over and over and over. So
that's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Real Jordan with today's Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, the Bureau of Land Management is taking action to end the use of M44 devices that deliver sodium cyanide on public land. This decision would build on existing limitations in several states and extend across all public lands managed by the BLM. To implement the decision, the BLM has renewed a Memorandum of Understanding with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services Wildlife Services regarding wildlife damage management. The BLM will also amend internal guidance as appropriate to clarify the prohibition. An M44 is a spring-loaded device staked in the ground at surface level that can be loaded with a sodium cyanide capsule and baited to attract predator species. When triggered, the spring ejects a lethal dose of cyanide into the biting animal's mouth, resulting in death within 1 to 5 minutes. The BLM's decision to ban M44s that deliver sodium cyanide on public lands follows existing bans or use limitations in Idaho, Oregon, California, and Washington. There is pending legislation to ban the use of M44s on all public lands, and their use is currently prohibited on National Wildlife Refuges and National Park Service lands. Less than 1% of the M44s used by APHIS Wildlife Services in 2022 were on BLM-managed lands. M44 cyanide devices have been implicated in several incidents, including one in Idaho in 2017 when a family dog was killed and a child injured after accidentally triggering a device placed on public land 400 feet from their home. In another incident, a recreationist triggered an M44 cyanide device while recreating on BLM-managed public lands, resulting in long-term injury and ongoing health problems. This is a win for human and livestock health, as BLM-managed public lands are vital to agricultural grazing in California and the western United States. BLM California administers approximately 665 active grazing allotments utilized by 553 grazing permittees each year, encompassing about 6.1 million acres of public land. BLM typically authorizes around 472,000 animal unit months for this public grazing acreage, one unit equating to the amount of forage a cow and her calf or six sheep would consume in a month. The BLM's ban on M44 devices that delivers sodium cyanide will not result in additional limits on other predator control techniques on public land. For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian Terman.
The Department of Water Resources announced an initial state water project allocation forecast of 10% of requested supplies for 2024. Current reservoir storage and assumptions of very dry conditions are the basis for the initial allotment. DWR Director Carla Namath said they're hopeful that the El Nino pattern will provide some wet weather, but so far the water year is off to a slow start. This initial allocation is determined by factors such as October and November precipitation, dry soil conditions, runoff, and storage levels in Lake Oroville. Fortunately, due to record snowfall last water year, most state reservoirs remain above average for this time of year. Historically, initial allocation forecasts tend to be conservative after exceptionally wet years. In water year 2018, for example, the initial allocation was 15%, following an 85% final allocation in 2017. Bayer has announced advancements in its strategic collaboration with Microsoft. The collaboration aims to address the lack of data interoperability in agriculture. New data connectors facilitate the secure and compliant exchange of farm data between Bayer's digital farming product, Climate FieldView, and original equipment manufacturers through Microsoft's Azure Data Manager for Agriculture platform. Once initiated by a farmer, enterprise customers from across the agri-food value chain can now connect and auto-sync planting, application, and harvest activity. In its early stages, Bayer's presenting an agriculture co-pilot and testing multiple scenarios with internal teams to discover where large language model capabilities can add value through the ability to interact with agronomic data. The collaboration will reportedly offer ready-to-use capabilities for businesses, and both companies plan to expand Azure Data Manager with agriculture-specific connectors. As part of the USDA's efforts to support agricultural exports, plans for ag trade missions in 2024 are being set. Trade missions are scheduled for a variety of key markets for American ag products. Throughout the year, delegations will be going to Korea, India, Canada, Colombia, Vietnam, and Morocco. The agribusiness trade missions will be coming on the heels of recent trade policy successes. Vietnam opening its market for U.S. grapefruit exporters and India dropping a variety of retaliatory tariffs are seen as wins for American agriculture. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack noted that market diversification is key for helping to expand growth opportunities. U.S. ag exports have been setting records over the past 2 years, hitting $196 billion in 2022. The ag trade missions will complement the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program in enabling new market opportunities and expanding existing market presence. California growers are getting closer to having another ant management tool available to use in a variety of crops. With an array of research supporting its efficacy, UC Cooperative Extension entomology and pest management advisor David Haviland said that hydrogel technology has a few registration hurdles to get through, but there is positive momentum.
You know, the alginate hydrogels fall under some laws that make them exempt from registration because they're food products. The polyacrylamides would require registration in California. Another 48 states, no. As far as thimethoxam, which is one of the active ingredients that we're using for conventional blocks, there's a supplemental label in place that allows the use. And then for spinosad, which is what we're using in most of our organic trials, efforts to get that label still need to happen. So yes, lots of fronts, lots of moving parts, but in all areas, making progress.
The California Department of Pesticide Regulation is seeking feedback on a proposed regulation to provide public access to pesticide information prior to applications. The regulation builds on existing procedures and would require licensed applicators to electronically submit information 24 hours in advance and 48 hours for soil fumigants to DPR for public posting through a new statewide information system. DPR is holding 3 public meetings on the proposed regulation. The first hearing is scheduled for Wednesday, December 13th at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. The second event will take place at the Ventura County Fairgrounds on Thursday, December 14th. The final hearing in the series will be held via Zoom on Tuesday, December 19th. All hearings will begin at 4:30 in the afternoon, and all comments on the proposed regulation will need to be received by January 12th. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
USDA is predicting a modest increase in this year's farm production expenses. Gary Crawford reports.
As farmers balance their financial books for 2023, analysts at the USDA say that on average, those producers' expense ledgers will show yet another increase this year in production expenses.
One of the things that you've seen here is obviously a lot of volatility in input prices.
But USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says a lot of that volatility happened in the early months of 23. And for all of the year, USDA is projecting a 3.5% increase in overall farm production expenses. Two big contributors to that, a 43% hike in interest expenses and a 19% rise in expenses involved in purchasing livestock.
But we do have things moderating, like fuels and oils and fertilizer, things which had seen big run-ups in, say, the previous 18 months, showing some actual decline.
Meyer says farmers will have spent about 14% less for fertilizer this year, also less for pesticides, fuels, and livestock feed. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have our statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Why you may be hearing more about the nutritional benefits of wheat. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
Have you made your donation yet this year to the National Association of Farm Broadcasters Foundation Booster Club? Your contribution helps ensure a strong future for the farm broadcasting profession and industry. It also helps keep the quality and viability of the farm broadcasting profession and industry at the highest level through education, scholarships, and internships. This month, your donation of $25 or more will also give you the chance to win a mystery prize that will be mailed to you. Go to nefbfoundation.com to donate today.
Consumers continue to want more nutritional information, so the Wheat Foods Council is launching a social media campaign that educates fitness professionals and trainers about the benefits of wheat foods in healthy diets. The new WFC campaign is on Facebook and Instagram. It provides evidence-based information on the nutritional and performance advantages of wheat foods. Among those advantages is how wheat foods serve as a reliable and efficient source of energy. The campaign also helps dispel myths about wheat foods and fosters a deeper understanding of the positive impact they have on performance and well-being. WFC President Tim O'Connor says by harnessing the power of social media, the campaign creates a dialogue, encourages knowledge sharing, and inspires a shift in how the fitness industry views wheat foods in a healthy lifestyle. Longleaf pine trees are making a comeback in the Southeast. With some help from several dedicated groups, Gary Crawford has more.
At one time, the longleaf pine tree and its unique ecosystem covered 90 million acres across the Southeast. But by 1995, it was down to just 3 million and shrinking. And so several organizations came together with one goal.
Bring back longleaf where it's appropriate and where we are able to manage it properly.
Carol Denhoff is president of the Longleaf Alliance. And as you heard, by the mid-1990s, total longleaf acreage had shrunk to 3 million acres. But
through the work that the Longleaf Alliance and our other partners within the America's Longleaf Restoration Initiative are doing, we're now at about 5.2 million acres of longleaf pine and growing.
And one of those partners that she talks about there in the Longleaf Restoration Initiative is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation is Robert Bonney, and he says the work being done to restore longleaf pine forests and maintain them is generating
positive outcomes for local economies, national defense, endangered species, forest resiliency, clean air and water, carbon sequestration, and climate change mitigation.
Of course, as we've already heard, there are dozens and dozens of groups and agencies and individuals working on the Longleaf Restoration Initiative.
I know from my days beginning in longleaf conservation over 30 years ago, the importance of working together as a team. We accomplish nothing alone.
To that end, in Washington, just a few days ago, the USDA hosted a gathering of groups working on this to, as Carol Denhoff put it, to celebrate what's been done over the last 15 years.
And think about what we will be doing for the next 15 years.
15 years ago, the Departments of Agriculture and the Department of Defense and Interior, those three signed an agreement to be full partners in restoring longleaf pine forests. And at this recent gathering, they signed a new agreement to renew the partnership
and guide us into the next 15 years of restoring our country's vital longleaf pine forests.
In Washington, this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I talked recently with a representative from Valent USA about their focus on sustainability. Here's that conversation.
Well, good morning. My name is Vince Fristucci, and I am a market segment manager with Valent USA.
So tell me what Valent has going on for sustainability.
So we have taken the approach that sustainability is really how farmers can describe the good that they do for the environment, whether it's the soil, the water, the air, and the communities that they work in. So we've created this series of icons that are science-based, and so it's in our culture that and arms them with the new vocabulary to talk about sustainability, whether it's a low use rate requiring fewer passes across the field, less fuel usage, and more effective treatment, and not having to haul a whole bunch of containers and boxes and totes around. But with a low use rate, it allows them to really be most effective with the chemistries that are going to address their problems the most efficiently. So from a sustainability standpoint, whether it reduces, increases worker efficiency and reduces worker exposure, those are the kind of things that we're trying to help them be able to talk with consumers, people that might be, you know, contracting their crops with them. And so that's the connection that we're trying to make between our products and how the consumer is king nowadays, that people want to know where their food came from and are they doing it responsibly. We just want to enable them to have that vocabulary to talk this new language in this new world.
So in what ways are you helping to give them that?
So we've introduced these 12 icons that are on our website, and they will make their way onto our packaging. And it specifically calls out areas that are around people, planet, and productivity. So if it's reducing food waste, you know, if our fungicide increases, or, you know, has a really high efficacy when you're talking about disease, that's going to reduce food waste because you're not throwing away or culling out things that have gotten rotten. So there's just different approaches that we're taking, whether it's soil health or that low use rate like I talked about. Are we increasing their worker safety? Are we making them more efficient or giving them the tools to be better stewards of the environment?
And that's so important. It's always been important, but it seems like now people are realizing how important that is. Do you have any other talking points, anything else that you want our listeners to know about sustainability?
The biggest takeaway is I've farmed and ranched my entire life, and people need to understand that our livelihoods are based upon responsible use of resources, and sustainability is just a new way for us to talk about the good that we do for the environment, and that's what we're here to help growers do.
Yeah, and you know what? You bring up a good point. It's something that has been done for a long time. It's just we're now talking about it more and have given it, you know, new buzzwords.
Absolutely. And so if we can create this new vocabulary to help people connect on what is important to them and how we now talk about that in the industry, we don't need to shy away from the practices that we have. We need to embrace it and give producers the tools to be able to talk confidently in their communities about what they do and how they produce the food for a growing population.
And how can growers access this information?
Growers can access all this information through our website at Valent.com. They can work with their local retailer that they get their ag inputs from. You can reach out and connect with a rep from Valent.com, and we're happy to provide them any information around our sustainability program as well as any of our products.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's interview segment.
Joined again this morning by our friends from Pinion Global, Tommy Irvin and Bill Hoover. And now last time we spoke, we highlighted some of the most common questions you folks are fielding from industry members. And so today I wanted to get into the Farm Bill a little bit. And now, Tommy, I know you and the team over there have been providing some insight on some of the specialty crop needs within the Farm Bill. And so what have been some of the priority areas that maybe need some more support or have seen some success there in getting some helpful language included in Farm Bill discussions?
Yeah, you know, we get reached out to a lot, especially out of our Kansas offices. We have good relationships with some of the congressmen in Kansas who have participated in Farm Bill legislation in the past. So oftentimes it's around whether, you know, an AGI limitation makes sense. One example would be, you know, several programs allow for a higher payment limitation if a certain percentage of your income comes from farm income. So one thing on the permanent specialty crop that's pretty prevalent is an IC disc, which is an export benefit for farmers. And that dividend from the IC disc was not being included as farm income, even though it's really related to the farm. And so we push pretty hard along with a lot of others. And a lot of the trade associations to get that included in that farm income definition, which it is now. They also added wages from a closely held C corporation, which previously wages weren't included in farm income. So they're always making changes and updating things as different business structures change, different things change. And we're just happy to be a part of those conversations ahead of time rather than after the fact and trying to get them fixed.
And now, in your experience, I was curious in what you've seen with this Farm Bill compared to maybe some of the previous ones. I know specialty crops have not always been front and center in some previous Farm Bill conversations. So does it seem like there's maybe some more receptiveness, or perhaps the specialty crop industry as a whole is maybe having its voice heard a little bit more compared to previous years?
I think so. I think it was pretty prevalent. You know, to take the World Ag Expo last year, huge presence from the Ag Committee there. So just the fact that many of them showed up, not just from California, but across the country, to have kind of a public forum and hear what the issues were for a lot of the people in the industries and several growers as well, you could tell that they were listening. Now it's just a matter of taking what they heard and putting it into action. So I do think that there's been more attention paid to the specialty crop industry than there has been in the past.
Yeah, that's certainly good news for specialty crop growers, maybe getting some more consideration there in the Farm Bill. And now moving over to Bill Hoover, manager for the business development team over at Pinion.
You'd noted that there are some changes coming down the line that are going to be impacting farming operations as it pertains to estate planning. And so, Bill, what might industry members want to prepare for, or how might they want to go about those changes?
There's various estate planning limitations and thresholds that are going to be changing over the next 18 to 24 months. And so it's always a good idea to refresh and update estate planning, legacy planning for generational transfer of assets and wealth. And, you know, I think it's a good idea to reach out to your, you know, advisors to touch on that, especially in this time frame, because I think as we get closer to that deadline and the potential of a new administration coming in that may also modify some of those guidelines, you need to stay current on what those rules are and how it might impact your individual situation. And, you know, I think farmers in general are not a big fan of sending checks off to the government. So,
yeah, I'd say that's a pretty fair assessment there. So just a good idea in general to maybe start having those conversations now, making sure plans are set, and hopefully avoid any kind of potential problems down the line with those changes coming.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think you just don't want any surprises, and that's what we're here for. We try to help avoid those surprises and provide, you know, guidance and, you know, a path forward to help resolve any of those challenges.
Yeah. Now, just lastly here, some of the Pinion team is going to be out at the upcoming Almond Conference, available to field some questions from industry members, right?
Yeah, we'll have a booth. It's number 1429, and we'll be there. Tommy will be there, and we'll have some of our other specialty resources available to discuss any topic that might be on their mind. And we'll have some demonstration of our automated back office resource, which essentially automates the data entry portion for a farm operation into their bookkeeping system. And provides a lot of that analytical information that Tommy mentioned earlier around what are my costs per acre at this point in the season, which in a lot of the systems they're using today, you just don't have access to that information easily. And you're always trying to do it in the spreadsheet kind of outside the system. And we feel like we've really got a super tool to kind of keep a farm operation, keeping their information available and timely, so it's more useful.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. As dairy calves travel from home farm to calf ranch, the stress of the move, contact with new animals, and a new environment can lead to respiratory disease. Chad Smith has more.
Dr. Joe Gillespie, DVM with Boehringer Ingelheim, talks about how metaphylaxis can be a useful tool in controlling bovine respiratory disease or pneumonia in young calves.
Metaphylaxis is a thought process of treating animals prior to or during early risk associated with some sort of disease. So what we're trying to do is if we have an animal that is at risk of exposure to a pathogen or getting the disease, we preemptively treat them with antibiotics to help reduce that chance for illness or sickness that may come after a stress event or something that could cause disease in those animals.
Gillespie talks about the management practices producers should have in place before implementing metaphylaxis.
The use of metaphylaxis is not really a blanket answer to all risk associated with bovine respiratory disease. The use of metaphylaxis is to help prevent the onset. So what's important prior to making the decision to do or not to do metaphylaxis is to understand how your cattle are managed. Are they under stress? Are they high-risk cattle that may have a greater risk of getting disease? And then understanding the management practices that you have to be able to manage that in particular. So, you know, our goal is not always to just use more antibiotics. It's to use antibiotics appropriately so that we have the best chance for success with whatever class of cattle we're dealing with.
He says contacting your veterinarian veterinarian is the first and most crucial step in implementing metaphylaxis.
He has the most likelihood of understanding what your risks are at your particular facility. He actually understands the pathogens that are at risk in your environment, and he can offer suggestions of products and routes of administration and timing for those types of products to make metaphylaxis successful. If we take the idea of just blanket treating all animals, we are not judiciously using antibiotics. But if we take the mindset working with our veterinarian to understand if there is truly risk in a group of cattle, and we use those antibiotics appropriately, utilizing the most appropriate time from treatment to onset of disease, and all of those factors together really help us use antibiotics more effectively.
He offers an example of metaphylaxis.
A great example is if you treat animals with a long-acting antibiotic as a metaphylaxis, then you can understand that for the next 5 to 7 days, you don't need to retreat animals. And that gives you a chance to get your management practices in place, cattle on the right nutritional plane and in the right state of health to make sure that you don't have a great deal of sickness following that. All those factors together really help us use antibiotics more appropriately.
For more information, go to BeringerIngelheim.com. Chad Smith reporting.
Crop growers received lower prices overall in October. So how did that contribute to the latest overall ag prices received index issued by USDA? Here's Rod Bain.
A drop in what crop producers received price-wise in October led to an overall decline in the USDA Agricultural Prices Index and prices received for commodities. The Crop Production Index reflected a 7.6% month-over-month decrease, as prices received for food grains such as wheat was the only category in that sector reflecting an increase, a 4.8% rise from the previous month. With the Livestock Production Index showing a 0.3% increase in October, the overall Ag Price Index indicated a 6.3% decline month over month. Minimal upticks in what meat, animal, and dairy producers received price-wise in October offset an over 2% decrease in prices for poultry and egg commodities. The prices paid index for inputs and services rose 0.1% from the previous month, due in part to higher prices for feeder cattle and fertilizer inputs and increased wages. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The U.S. Grain Council's Corn Harvest Quality Report shows this year's crop is the largest on record to have the lowest percentage of broken corn and foreign material in history. The average aggregate quality of the representative samples tested was better than the grade factor requirements for U.S. No. 1 grade. The report also says that 88% of the samples met the grade factor requirements for U.S. No. 1 grade and 96% met the grade factor requirements for U.S. No. 2 grade. USGC Chair Brent Boydston says the transparency this provides to buyers helps them make informed decisions and takes another step toward developing markets and enabling trade, as well as improving lives. He goes on to say this crop's incredible volume allows the U.S. to remain the world's leading corn exporter, accounting for an estimated 26% of global corn exports. The report is based on 611 yellow corn samples taken from 12 of the top corn states. However, the University of Illinois Farm Policy News website says the price of corn recently hit a three-year low mark. Supplies from Brazil and the U.S. surged while demand stagnated because of the high prices. Corn has traded around $4.50 a bushel recently after reaching more than $8 a bushel in May of 2022. The drop in corn prices was coming after America's farmers planted more corn last year in response to the higher prices. The Financial Times says Russia's invasion of Ukraine sent prices sharply higher last year, as did droughts in parts of South America. However, in response to the rising prices, corn demand fell for the first time in 10 years, contracting roughly 3% between 2022 and 2023. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.